This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org, and I encourage you to subscribe at progressive.org as well. I guarantee you, you won't be disappointed. Today, we're going to be talking about the economy and about how some hustlers on Wall Street brought the whole thing crashing down. And with me to make sense of this colossal mess is Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America and What We Can Do About It. Les Leopold, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Matt, thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's a great book. It's written in a way that everyone can understand, which is necessary because so many people have what I would call economic phobia. You know, they didn't take Ec 10 at school, or if they did, they're still having nightmares about it 10, 20, 30 years later. Why'd you decide to write this book?
I was really drawn to this story because I kept hearing about these things in the financial sector that were too hard for anybody to understand. And I just started having this feeling that if we didn't develop our financial literacy, we were no longer going to be citizens. And then sure enough, right while I was starting to think about this, the markets crashed. We had the huge meltdown. And I realized, this was the time to do it. And then right before my very eyes, in 3 weeks, we transferred about $1 trillion to Wall Street out of the taxpayers' funds. And I realized we were losing our citizenship because we really didn't understand what was going on.
Losing our citizenship, losing our wallet at the same time, or getting our wallet picked. I mean, I want to follow up on what you're saying there, because I remember reading an article by Paul Krugman, who's been pretty good on this all along. But I remember this was with the credit default swaps, and then he said there were some other more arcane things. He mentioned a couple three-letter initials, and then he said, forget about it. Don't ask, I think were the exact words he used. And at that point, it struck me that there's a whole thing going out there that they don't want us to know about, and it's too complicated for Paul Krugman even to boil down into a couple paragraphs in his column every couple of days at the New York Times, which has been pretty good, as I say. So if he thought it was too obscure or arcane for his readers at the prestigious New York Times, I mean, I got the feeling right then that the wool was way over our eyelids.
Yeah, and one of the only issues I take with Paul Krugman is he doesn't want to start the story early enough. Because this story really begins in the mid-70s, late 70s, early 80s, when for the first time in American history, a gap developed between workers' real wages, what they could really buy, and productivity. Now, productivity is just the best way to measure the wealth of a nation. The more you can produce per hour, the better off you are as a nation. And from World War II, for example, all the way to the mid-70s, every year productivity went up, every year real wages went up. And we were taught in graduate school and elsewhere that the two were joined at the hip, that you couldn't separate them. That's how wages went up. Productivity goes up, wages goes up. Then something amazing happened. Right then, we embarked on a bold new experiment, which was what would happen if we totally unleashed the financial sector from all these New Deal constraints, and if we changed the tax code so that money could flow to the top fraction of 1%, the theory was that this would unleash a gigantic economic boom in America and all boats would rise. Well, it sort of half worked. The boats for the top 10th of 1% really rose, and average real wages actually over the next 30 years have gone down by 18%. I don't like to throw statistics at people, but there's one that just there's actually a couple, but one that blows my mind is in 1970, if you looked at the top 100 CEOs and compared them to the average worker, the ratio was $45 to 1 in terms of compensation. By 2007, the ratio was 17-23 to 1. And that's a result not of an act of God, not because people, at the top got smarter. It's because we changed the rules of the game.
They're not 2,000 times as smart as they were.
No,
workers.
I don't think so. I don't think that human beings change that quickly.
There's another statistic there where you're graphing the disjointing of productivity and wages. You put a figure in there that if wages marched hand in hand with productivity as they were supposed to and did for four decades, that right now the median wage would be something like $65,000 or $70,000.
That's right. And all that money, which amounts to something like, you know, $3 trillion a year right now, that money goes to this top fraction of Americans. The last time we were able to look at this carefully was in 2006, and this is just unbelievable. The top one-tenth of 1% had as much income as the bottom 50%, right?
That's about as lopsided as you can get. I mean,
now, but the point of this is not just a moral question, right? This is an economic question, because where does all that money go? They couldn't find enough places in the real economy to invest it. They literally ran out of factories and startups and all that kind of stuff. And Wall Street understood this. And they invented many new financial instruments to suck up this extra money. And that created a giant galaxy of what I call fantasy finance instruments. And those are the instruments that crashed and turned into toxic assets.
Well, what are some of those fantasy finance
instruments? They have all kinds of great names, like, you know, synthetic collateralized debt obligations, which is the heart and soul of it. But the best way, I think, to view this is if your listeners have any understanding of fantasy sports, that's really the best analogy to understand this. And let's say fantasy baseball, which is going on right now. You have the real major leagues, 30 baseball teams, about 700 players. That's all you have. But you probably have a million people playing, or more, playing fantasy baseball, each of whom supposedly own real major league players. And they bet on their statistics, and money changes hands, and they have teams. And each of your fantasy baseball teams is like a synthetic derivative, because it's not, you don't really own the players. You own something that moves like the real players move. So you can have a million people playing a game where there are only 700 real, tangible assets, those real baseball players. Now imagine what happens if the major leagues go on strike. The major leagues go on strike, all those million players now have worthless assets. All the people who cater to them, who write books about it, who have websites and stat services, the ESPN, elaborate games, all that comes crashing down. So in this case, the underlying real assets were things like subprime mortgages, risky credit card debt, auto loans, things that sooner or later were not going to keep going up and up. And once they leveled off and started coming down a little bit, it crashed the value of all those fantasy finance things that were on top of it. So you had like kind of an upside down pyramid, all based on very few tangible assets, which, of course, is extremely risky. And that's what they mean by leverage. They don't mean that you just borrowed money. They mean that all these fancy finance things have no value anymore.
So the rich, the top 1% that got all this extra money that was robbed essentially from workers' productivity who didn't get it when they were earning it, they were looking for a place to put their so-called unearned income. They weren't content to get 3%, 4%, 5% at a treasury bill or a solid CD somewhere. So they were speculating with their money on the promise that they'd get more money, which is how Madoff suckered people in.
Exactly right.
And yet Wall Street was one big Madoff operation in a way. They were suckering rich people to give them money to buy to buy up bets upon bad bets upon bad bets, essentially. They were betting on some of these mortgages that they wouldn't go bust, and then they were betting on that bet or getting an insurance on that bet.
Well, that last point is very critical. First of all, every time Wall Street created one of these things, the fees embedded inside, and someone who reads the book, I think I've broken it down very simply, you can see how they built it up so it looked like it was safe. But each time they did this, the fees inside were so colossal that the temptation to keep doing more and more of it was overwhelming. This was the most profitable thing ever done in the history of Wall Street. And to cover what was so fantastic is, you know, they pooled all these assets into like subprime mortgages into big pools, and they chopped them and sold them. But after a while, which, by the way, led to the demand for more and more mortgages. It wasn't that people – the demand for housing actually was created by the desire of Wall Street to have more and more raw material for their fantasy finance. But after a while, that got too cumbersome. They actually did it all through – credit default swaps, which were insurance policies. So they were selling insurance policies to create new pools that were based of all these insurance policies, because that was faster and quicker. And then everybody figured they were covering their bets by taking out these insurance policies. Unfortunately, the insurers, AIG, for example, by the way, they can't call it insurance, because if they called it insurance, it would be regulated. So that's why they came up with the word credit default swap, which means it's not regulated. Well, AIG got into the credit default swap business to the tune of $450 billion. They couldn't pay their bets, and it had the government let them go under. Virtually every major bank in the world would have collapsed, would have been in the red, because they all were relying on this insurance to cover their fantasy bets.
I'm speaking with Les Leopold. He's the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and what we can do about that. This last point that you were making, Les, and you're listening to Progressive Radio, by the way. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. This last point about if the government hadn't bailed out AIG and a subsidiary point, which is, you know, if the government had bailed out the bank subsequently, that the whole system would have crashed. Is that your argument, that it had no other choice but to bail these out? What would really have been the consequence if the government had said, well, you're going to suffer the consequences of your stupidity and greed?
Well, I personally think that was not a realistic option. Those who say, well, just let them all crash, you know, we'd be selling pencils on the street right now. There would be no economic activity going on. It would take a decade or longer. We would be in a Great Depression.
So we'd be selling apples.
Yeah, there's just nothing that could have survived a total freeze. You know, there would not be money coming out of an ATM. It would have just frozen the whole system up even worse than it did. The question is, what's the terms of the bailouts? Are we just going to bail them out and then give it back to private investors and start the casino up again? Or are we going to use this period as a chance to truly change the nature of the casino? And that's where I take issue.
Well, I agree with you on that. Certainly that the government, when it had Bank of America and Citigroup essentially on their knees in the White House begging for money, they didn't act like they were begging for money, and the government didn't act like it had them over a barrel. I mean, the government basically said, do you want $800 billion or not? And it didn't tie anything to it except a little something on executive compensation, which I think is an overblown issue. I think the real issue is, are we going to make these banks behave? Which is to say, are we going to make the banks, the government could have forced the banks to write down by 30% all its mortgages.
They could have done a whole bunch of things. First of all, it's important to understand that the whole financial sector is on the dole. It's not just a few bad banks that we're saving. The good banks would be bad banks had we not saved the bad banks or the AIGs. So the whole sector
is tied together.
They're all tied together. It's the interconnectedness that is making this crisis so severe. The other thing to remember is that the actual real economy didn't do anything to deserve this recession.
Right.
Depression, it all happened.
I mean, let's look at what else the government could have done when the banks were there just prostrate.
Okay.
Couldn't they have said, you know, any of these credit default swaps or obligations that you have to each other that are unregulated to each bank coming to the government for money, any of those interbank obligations we're going to render null and void right now?
Well, it's funny. My mind went a different direction. I mean, that may be possible, but what I concentrated on, I wanted to get back to the root problem, which is the two things that have to happen to get us out of this and not to create it again is we've got to get money out of Wall Street into the real economy. We've got to get money from the top of the income spectrum down to the middle and the bottom.
So how could you have done that when they were desperate?
Okay. The first thing you could have done is said, all right, a wage cap across the board. Nobody gets paid more than the President of the United States in the financial sector. Period. The end. That's what we're doing. You don't like it? Go work in another sector. You want to go work overseas? Go work overseas. And all this cry about we're going to lose our best talent, our financial innovators, we should have had a party for them because it's the financial innovators that got us into this mess. Let them go. That would have discouraged all the graduates from business school to spend their time in fantasy finance as opposed to medicine, education, engineering, and all the things that we need them for. That's the first thing we should have done. The second thing we should have done is listen to this Representative Peter DeFazio, who stole one of my ideas, and Dean Baker's, which is to put a small tax on each and every financial transaction so that every time they zing currencies around the globe, every time they do any kind of deal, financial deal, Ka-ching goes money into the federal government every single time. This could be somewhere between, you could get somewhere between $50 billion and $500 billion a year. His bill, DeFazio's bill, was that's how they pay us back for TARP. But what it also does is it takes away some of the word they use, the arbitrage profits, because it now becomes more expensive to make all these rapid transactions. So it would actually decrease the amount of profit somewhat within the financial sector and start moving money into federal infrastructure investments. And that's where we have to go. A wage cap and moving and taxing the money out of the sector, it would make a huge, huge difference.
I'm speaking with Les Leopold. He's author of The Looting of America, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. You were just talking about these transaction taxes, sometimes also called a Tobin tax, after a professor or economist who's no longer with us. I do think those things could have worked, or still could work, certainly. But I'm just wondering, you know, Americans looking at the numbers of $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion on these banks and financial institutions, and then we're always told we don't have money for the things we need, like healthcare, which just drives me absolutely crazy. But if just leaving the government with that $2 trillion to fix this economic problem, couldn't they have fixed it as easily by buying up, 80,000 or 100,000 or a couple million mortgages?
Well, I would have done it a completely different way. I did some quick math. And if you took the stimulus program, that's $787 billion, and let's say it costs about $60,000 to produce a job, roughly $45,000 to $50,000 plus benefits and administrative costs, you could have created a Works Progress Administration in this country that would have produced over 13 million jobs right now. We could have people, you know, weatherizing every single home in the country, every single business in the country. We could be rebuilding the infrastructure with that same money. The TARP money that they're trying to buy out these toxic assets, that isn't working. They can't figure out how to do it. If we would have literally created this massive number of jobs, you would have taken the misery out of away from – there's approximately 28 million people that are either underemployed or unemployed right now. More people have lost their jobs during this recession since any recession since the Great Depression. I mean, this is severe. And yes, the best way to deal with a mortgage is to make sure the person has a job. It's very interesting. For $300 billion, we could have bought up all the mortgages, right? But they didn't do that because the mortgages were leveraged so many different times under these fantasy finance instruments that you had to buy up $4 trillion to take care of the $300 billion. So I just assume first give people work, then worry about the other stuff.
And why isn't the Obama administration doing that? Why wasn't that one of their proposals?
Because it doesn't have enough of a base within the Democratic Party to do that, because they view government as bad.
Who's the they here?
They, meaning moderate Democrats, view government as bad. They're afraid. In general, I think both the Obama administration and much of the Democratic Party is afraid that they were going to that they're going to interfere too much with private enterprise and the financial community. I think it's important to understand this distinction between the financial sector and the real economy. John Maynard Keynes was not sure, the great economist, was not sure that you could have a vibrant private sector free enterprise economy and let Wall Street do whatever it wanted to do. It's not clear to me that you can run a private sector in the banking community. It's not clear to me that you can do that and not have the economy continually crash.
And the finance has absorbed now close to 40% of the economy. I mean, it's just gargantuan, or became gargantuan, over the last 10 years.
Well, that's what happens when we embarked on this grand experiment. We have to undo this experiment. We have to do all the things that you need to do to raise real wages. Higher minimum wage, more unionization, more controls on globalization, all the kinds of things that we were – a year ago, we would have been laughed out of the room for having the conversation. Now it's a very practical solution. I just before I got here, I looked at the wage distribution numbers and tax receipt numbers since 1900. I have a chart of this stuff that somebody gave me. And the last time we had this outrageous distribution of wealth was 1928 and 1929. Mm. And nobody can tell me that this is a coincidence. The best years were from the 50s you know, through the late 60s and mid 70s, precisely the years when the middle class was formed in this country.
Well, you make a suggestion that I made in the pages of The Progressive, that we out and out nationalize a couple of these big banks. I was suggesting Citigroup and Bank of America, and that we don't send them back into the private sector right away, but we run them for the people. And this isn't an argument you're hearing much. To the extent that nationalization was uttered by anybody, including I think Alan Greenspan even, and a couple of Republicans in the Congress, they wanted it just to be, you know, a car wash. You go in, clean it up, send it back out. And there are very few voices out there that says, look, we've got to run a bank with the public ownership for the public to do things that banks should do but aren't wanting to do because they're structured with the profit motive, turning them into another direction. How would it work if the government owned Bank of America? We do own Bank of America. Well, and say, well, how would it be if we ran it?
Well, I think now's a very good time to find out, because what we really want to do is make banking boring again. We want it to do what it's supposed to do, which is move capital from savers to where it's needed. We do not need it to be a casino. This has been the problem since private banking began, you know, 300 or 400 years ago. It's always been this problem of there's it has a function as a utility, as a public utility, and it runs towards speculation. And you need to find ways to separate the two. And I think running a few banks in the national interest would be a very, very good idea. Let's see what happens. And again,
But Obama doesn't want to run it in the public interest. He wants to run it like a private. He wants to be a silent private partner.
Well, here's what's going on right now. If you watch the debate over these financial reforms, you're going to see an incredible lobbying effort. This you talk about outrageous. We've given taxpayer money to Wall Street. They're now funding an enormous lobbying machine to go after Congress and the Obama administration to stop these financial reforms from having any teeth at all. They don't want a consumer protection agency because I think they prefer that we get fleeced by the mortgage broker of our choice. That's what they'd rather have. They don't want to have any kind of controls on that. They don't want to have controls on certain derivatives, the ones that are the real dangerous ones. They don't want to have control because those are the profitable ones. So there's a vicious cycle going on, which is when something gets very big, once we let the genie out of the bottle, getting it back in is going to require something like a movement. There is going to actually have to be – people are going to have to get outraged. What I worry about, and I worry a lot about this, is if unemployment continues to go up and up and up, that you could get instead of a progressive backlash, you could get a very right-wing populist backlash.
And we're getting that with the teabag movement.
Yep, and it could expand because a nation that can't provide employment for its own people any government that lets that happen is going to get voted out of office. And after a while, even though it's not Obama's fault, it's going to be Obama's problem.
I'm speaking with Les Leopold. He's the author of The Looting of America. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. Let's talk a little bit about some of Obama's rhetoric, because in your book, The Looting of America, Les Leopold, you criticize the notion that we are all to blame. And that seems to be a favorite kind of trope of Obama's. You know, there was crazy spending going out there on Wall Street and crazy spending going out there on Main Street. What's wrong with that trope?
Well, it just doesn't explain what happened. It's just like a historical fiction. What actually happened was workers' wages didn't go up. There was a huge amount of money that went to the super rich. That ended up in Wall Street, which led to these fantasy finance instruments. Money got loaned back at cheap rates then to working people, basically. The indebtedness of the average family in America went from like 60 cents on a dollar to $1.20 on a dollar. There's a limit to how much indebtedness can go up for a family because you have to make the payments. It hit its ceiling. And because it couldn't go up anymore, the whole thing crashed. You can find blame in any individual, but you cannot make the case that somehow a low-income home buyer who couldn't make payments because they didn't quite, you know, understand that the teaser rate was going to double down the road, that person did not crash the economy. All the rules that we set up that allowed Wall Street to sell that mortgage six or seven times over in their fantasy finance scheme, that's the problem.
A lot of those rules came through with the Clinton era, with the deregulation and the Commodities Futures Trading Act.
This whole mantra caught on both with Democrats and Republicans, the whole ideology of deregulation. You know, the person who should be given a little bit of a trophy in all this is Brooksley Bourne, this courageous woman who, during the Clinton administration, said, hey, wait a second, if we don't regulate this stuff, we're going to have a crash. And they basically, you know, ran her out of town. And Senator Phil Graham sort of put together this midnight bill that got through the Clinton administration that made it illegal to regulate credit default swaps, those insurance policies. So now you had hundreds of trillions of dollars of credit default swaps totally unregulated.
Now, Republicans like to say, well, it was all the subprime lending that was mandated by Congress to go to all those minorities, and they bankrupted the system.
Yeah, you know, it not only is that wrong, it's absolutely dangerous because, in fact, it was the it was getting the government out of the way that's caused this crash. It was undoing the New Deal program, which Republicans spent all their energy elites spent a huge amount of money investing in people to undo that whole regime. It was getting the government out. You know, people who've looked carefully at the community Reinvestment Act, where that provides encourages banks to give money to low income people to buy homes and such. Those mortgages are doing fine. Those aren't the people that can't pay their mortgages. They're doing actually quite well. So it has nothing to do with a little bit of liberal largesse on the part of the government. We just went through the biggest era of financial deregulation since the 1920s, and we're getting exactly the same results. This isn't a question of morality, good guys and bad guys. This is just economic clarity that we need here. You deregulate and you give money to the top 0.1%, and you're going to get a crash. Just a question of when.
Les Leopold, why do you think Obama's got some of these deregulators as his chief economic advisors? Larry Summers was one there in the Clinton administration. Geithner is certainly not Joseph Stiglitz. What's going on there?
It's a good question. I think he feels that they're smart and that he'd rather have people who really know the ins and outs of this as opposed to people who are just going to kind of criticize it. But that part doesn't worry me. What worries me is where's the pressure from the popular movement on Obama to do more? I mean, it's the old line with Roosevelt. If you remember, I think it was A. Philip Randolph or somebody came in demanding this, that, and the other. And Roosevelt looked at him and said, I agree. Now go out there and force me to do it. Make me do it. So the rest of us have to make Obama do it as opposed to sitting back and saying, oh, do it for us. So, and what's missing right now, the difference between now and the 30s, is that we don't have the grassroots and institutional popular movements, the progressive movement, the labor movement, Townsend movement in California, all these different movements that were pressuring from the progressive side to have huge changes. So what you have is Obama really being pushed from the right all the time, and that's what you're going to get.
We got to push him from the left. You're absolutely right about that. Thanks so much for being my guest today, Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America.
Thank you so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.